John William King is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put King to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the death in Texas, the state responsible for more than half of the U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue with criminal defense attorney Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Huhan, and special interview guest Dave Atwood, a leading anti-death penalty activist and author. He has observed King's case closely during the 20 years since his conviction. The Execution Watch for John William King begins.
Good evening and welcome to Execution Watch. Hi, I'm Marlo Blue. Welcome and thank you for tuning in to Execution Watch on this 24th of April, 2019. We're broadcasting from the studios of KPFT Houston 90.1 FM to bring you live coverage of the execution of John King. It's the latest in a long line of executions by the state of Texas. Like all executions, King represents the expenditure of tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer money. That includes not just the high cost of trial and appeals for the condemned, but also the cost of the many capital cases in which prosecutors fail to convince jury to vote for a death sentence that sticks. You can learn more about Texas executions on our website, executionwatch.org, where you will also find recordings and summaries going back to 2008. As you listen to our unique coverage of this latest execution, ask yourself, do I feel millions and millions of dollars safer than if the condemned were imprisoned for life? Joining me in the studio tonight will be Larry Douglas. He will be giving us an analysis of the case to tell us what's going on. And later we're going to have a special interview with a very special guest, Dave Atwood. But for right now, let's go to Huntsville Live, where our reporter Linda Huhan is standing outside of the death house. Linda, this is Marlo Blue. Tell us what's going on where you are. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties. As soon as we get her back on the line, we will bring her to you. Let's start off with Larry Douglas. Larry, explain, this is a very high-profile case of John King.
Right. Most Houstonians probably remember, although it's been 20 years ago, but this happened in Jasper, Texas, toward the east of Houston, northeast of Houston, near the Beaumont area, a little bit north of Beaumont. Back in June 7th, 1998, okay, more than 20 years ago, John Bird, a black man, his dismembered body was found. That is, his torso, his legs, and left arm were found. And then up the street, they noticed other parts of his body, his head and the other arm. And the pathologist looked at it and said, this appears to be consistent with somebody having been dragged along the street. Somebody has had his ankles tied, and they dragged the rest of his body, and then the head and arm came off.
We're going to go into a little more of the detail because it is an excruciating detail of what actually happened to Mr. King, Mr. Bird, excuse me. But right now, let's do go to Huntsville and talk with Linda Huhan. Linda. Linda. Linda.
Yes.
This is Marlo Blue in the studio here at 90.1 FM. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Yes.
Can you tell us about what's going on there outside of the death house?
Well, there is a lot of people here, and I mean all nationalities. It's really great to see everybody coming together. We have friends of Mr. Byrd here who are very much against the death penalty and against the killing. And it's really uplifting to be here. It's very nice to see all these people coming together.
Are there a lot of signs this time? Is there opposition as well as support?
Well, there on our side, there's no opposition. And we can't really see the other side. It does not look like there's a lot of people over there.
Of course, we've heard that there was a lot of international interest specifically in this and a lot of media attention because this was such a high-profile case. Have you seen, are the witnesses there? Have they crossed over yet?
No, they have not, but there are no witnesses. He did not want any witnesses. He said that he didn't want anybody to see him die. He didn't want them to remember him that way. He has none.
We had heard that the victim's sister, Luvon Harris, was going to be there in Huntsville. Have you seen her?
Yes, she's here, and so is his son.
And his son's name is, do you know?
I don't know the son's name, no, but he does not want the execution to go through. And neither really does the sister. I mean, the sisters are upset, but they're not, you know, they don't want the execution to happen.
I believe there was another sister as well, Betty Boatner. Is she there tonight?
I have not seen her, no.
We have heard that she had given her forgiveness to John King.
Yes, they both have.
Very interesting. Linda, would you please call us when you hear something?
Yes, we're logged into the Supreme Court, and as soon as we hear something, we'll let you know.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with our reporter from outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas, Linda Hujan. For those of you who may be tuning in right now to try and get Arab voices, please join us again next week. They will be back in their regularly scheduled time spot. Now let's go back to Larry Douglas. Larry.
Well, the forensics examiners jumped in to try to figure out what the reason for the murder. They tracked back from where the torso and the parts of his body were found, the legs were found, and about 3 miles up the road, they noticed a scene that looked like there was probably a fight there, and there was quite a bit of evidence that they picked up a cigarette lighter with a KKK and possum on it. Pack of cigarettes, bottle of beer, button from Byrd's shirts, his baseball cap, and a wrench that had Barry on it. So this whole incident seemed to have occurred Friday, Saturday night, Sunday morning. So Byrd had gone to a party that Saturday night and was walking back to his house. And so when they started to try to put the whole thing together, people noticed, well, yeah, we was at a party, and we did see him walking down the street away from the party, and then we saw him later on. He was in the back of a pickup truck. There were three white boys in the cab, and there was a pickup truck he was riding in. So it didn't take long for with the description that he got, a primer gray pickup truck. So the police stopped that primer gray pickup truck the next day, Monday morning. And when they took the truck in, they found his DNA and so forth on the truck. And there was a lot of evidence there that they were able to match and charge three individuals, the three white boys in the truck. And that they were William King, John King, John William King, along with Lawrence Brewer and Sean Barry. Sean Barry was the owner and driver of the truck. And the other two guys were riding with him. And the way they put the case together, they were suggesting that it appeared that John King was the ringleader. He went to trial first. He was found guilty first, given the death penalty.
They were all tried separately.
They were all tried separately. It appears that Barry Barry got a life sentence. He appeared to have cooperated with law enforcement. Brewer has already been executed. Brewer was executed back in 2011. The way the whole matter's worked out for John King is that he's had some success in his post-conviction remedies, and he's seeking one right now. Right now, what's going on is the strongest argument that John King has is that he presented an argument to his lawyers of actual innocence, saying you guys need to try this case as an actual innocence case. I didn't do it. I was someplace else. The lawyers didn't really follow that line of defense. But they didn't just refute the line of defense. They didn't outright admit he was guilty. They just defended him. And right now, what's happened? There's a McCoy case decided recently, saying that a defendant is entitled to direct his lawyer as to his theory of the defense. And so that's where the fine line is right now that's being discussed. Well, as to John King's case now, because he's exhausted his pretty much most of his all of his appellate remedies, his post-conviction remedies. But this is some new law that might or might not apply to him, because the McCoy case is not necessarily retroactive. His argument that it is. And the argument against it said that it was not specifically retroactive and it should not apply in this case. And when that argument was rejected by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, they decided the case 5-4, saying that it. So four of those justices decided, well, no, maybe we should take a look at this. And find and figure out whether he is entitled to have his lawyer follow more closely his concerns, his directive that his argument of actual innocence was something that ought to have been more forcefully argued to the jury. Now the way the whole thing happens is the way the case that the prosecutor presents the case is that their theory is that after James Byrd got into the back of the truck, that they took him to a secluded location and that they killed him. There would seem to have been a fight. Okay, the location where the kidnapping occurred. This is a death penalty case, and because it becomes a death penalty case because it was a killing that occurred in the course of committing another felony, specifically enumerated felony, this being kidnapping. So the defense did contest the fact that it was a kidnapping, but you know the facts seem to show that when you fight a guy, throw him down, put a chain around his legs and drag him, that does constitute kidnapping. Now, interestingly enough, most people think about this case as the one that resulted in hate crime legislation in Texas.
It's very famous for that, of course.
And it did. But it didn't change the Texas death penalty statute, though. So were this case tried today, it would be under the same Texas death penalty statute that does not allow for a case being elevated to a death case because of hate crime. So although there is hate crime legislation in Texas now, hate crime law in Texas now, it in no way impacts how death penalty cases are handled. Other cases, but not death penalty cases. But anyway, getting back to the state's theory of the case, there seems to be no argument that Sean Barry, the owner of the truck and the driver of the truck, did the driving. And at his trial, Lawrence Brewer actually admitted to killing James Byrd. There was a fight at the at the remote location. James Byrd was tied to the back of a truck and dragged along the street for a little over 3 miles, and then the portion of his body was left in the front of a church. John King's defense of actual innocence, his theory is that, look, I wasn't even there. What happened was, Sean Berry knew James Byrd from jail, and they were doing drugs together. And so his claim was that that James Byrd was in the process of selling Sean Berry some steroids. And so his theory is that, well, what happened was we gave him a ride. Berry gave him a ride. And then Berry and Byrd wanted to talk business. So we stopped at a convenience store, and there was a deal going on between the two of them. So based on them doing a deal, Byrd and Berry were in the cab of the truck. And so Brewer and I got in the back. And so when Brewer and I got in the back of the truck, they kept doing whatever they were doing, and they dropped us off. And after they dropped us off, I don't know what happened. So it appears that Sean Berry might have killed him. And, you know, Sean Berry is a snitch. So he gave evidence to law enforcement to save his own hide, but he's a snitch. The problem with that defense is that there were things that tied tied John King to the scene. Okay, his cigarette lighter was there. He said, "Well, I lost my cigarette lighter." But the evidence seemed to contradict that, because he'd lost it before, but he found it and it was at the scene. And the cigarette lighter was a KKK cigarette lighter, and it says had the word possum on it, which was his nickname in prison. Also, there was a cigarette butt that had his DNA on it. And so he said, "Well, you know, I put cigarette butts in the ashtray of my friend all the time. That doesn't mean I was there." Then there was some clothing and shoes that had his DNA on it. And there was some of his DNA, some of Byrd's DNA that was actually in the apartment that all these guys shared together. But in any event, his lawyer did what he could at trial. Did not present a strong case of actual innocence, but actually did present almost everything that John King instructed him to pursue. The other thing that King complained about was that his lawyer did not find his alibi witness. He said, "I've got an alibi witness who was at the apartment, who saw me." Would describe him. "Oh, he was a young white boy." "Okay, fine. So we'll go out and try to find him." So he sent an investigator out, and they checked all around the scene and could not find the person that King had identified. So he says, "Well, I went out to look for him, and I couldn't find him." Well, your failure to find him somehow means that you're ineffective as counsel. So that ineffective assistance of counsel based on the actual innocence argument was primary. That was the primary thing that has really kept John King alive even till today. Now, where it's going to turn out now, I have no idea.
No, which venue was this actually tried in?
This was in Jasper, in the courthouse in Jasper. Yeah.
Jasper's a pretty small town over there in East Texas.
Jasper is a small town, and then it was tried in the racial element was strong in Jasper. Okay, I mean, the thing is, I'm told that in Jasper, there was even the public cemetery was segregated. Okay, there was a fence between the white graves and the black graves, but they stopped doing that. Okay, as a result of this, John King was noted as being a strong leader in the Confederate Knights of America, KKK.
KKK.
And there was evidence, his whole background of the Aryan Brotherhood and so forth, that did come in. His lawyer tried to keep it out, saying it was presidential. Okay. And it's interesting to me how when you're trying cases, the prosecutors always mention to the jury that we don't have to prove motive. It's just not a requirement. But if they've got some strong motive evidence, strong prejudicial evidence about motive, they're going to put it on. And they really hammered him with it. He had a strong racist past with the tattoos and tattoos of a black man being hanged and other things. He had a lot of that with him, and they hit him hard with all of that. Now, his defense to that was, look, I went to prison, okay? So when I'm in prison, I've got to protect myself from the black guys. And so that's what happened. The white guys in prison have to band together. But before I went to prison, didn't have any of that. But once I got in prison, I had to, that was my survival mechanism. Once I left prison, I left that behind. I still got the KKK lighter and I still got the tattoos, but I left all that behind. But anyway, he exhausted his post-conviction remedies. And now his lawyers have done a good job for him, actually all the way through.
The time is now 6:23. You're listening to Execution Watch. This is a very special program that comes to you every time that the state of Texas puts someone to death. And tonight we are here in vigil for the execution of John King. With me in the studio, of course, is Larry Douglas. And we're going to be bringing in Dave Atwood in just a moment. There is still no word from the Supreme Court, and that's why we believe that the chaplain has still not yet crossed over, but still no word at this point in time. If you're listening or tuning in order to listen to Arab Voices, please check back next week. They will be here in their regularly scheduled time. Let's bring in Dave Atwood right now. Dave, you've long been an advocate against the death penalty and have stood in vigil for years for so many of these. Tell us a little bit about your relationship as it was with the family of James Byrd and how they interact into this.
Okay, thank you. And it's very nice to be here, although I don't... not happy I'm here because of an execution.
It's the only show we always hope gets canceled.
Right, absolutely. And thank you, Mr. Douglas, for your analysis there. I didn't know, by the way, that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals had voted 5-4 to proceed with the death penalty for King. That's amazing. I've always had this thing, if you have a court, an important court like that, that is that divided, including the Supreme Court. It doesn't work this way, I know, that if it's that close, something like the death penalty ought to be taken off the books for that person. I know it doesn't work that way, but I've always had that sort of gut feeling, even with the Supreme Court. So my first, when this crime, this horrible hate crime, racist hate crime happened, it was, of course, in the news big time in Houston and really across the country. And that's when I first knew about it. I was invited to go down to the Shape Community Center because they were going to have a press conference concerning the James Byrd Jr. murder. And I went down and... the people that were there were Martin Luther King III, Dick Gregory, the comedian activist. I think of him more as a activist, but he really is a comedian too, who recently passed away. And the Byrd children. And the one that spoke up that I recall mostly was Ross Byrd, the son. Ross was in the army when this happened, and he was there, and they were all there to speak out against the death penalty for all three men, including John King. And that always, I'm so impressed when I see particularly members of the family who have experienced this horrible thing happening to their family, when they speak out against the death penalty. And the one that was doing it that day was Ross Byrd, and he had a big sign that he carried saying, "Thou shalt not kill." That was his sign. But all three of them, King and Dick Gregory and Ross Byrd, particularly spoke out against the death penalty. And that was my introduction, really, to the family, the children in particular. I think I've met one or two of the sisters too, but the children were the ones that I had the most contact with, and it was very interesting. It wasn't like and also the Byrd's previous wife had also spoken out, and I had I'm always just amazed when a family or members of a family will speak out against the death penalty when one of their family members has been murdered. It's something in certain people that seem to say, you know, they say, well, this is not going to bring back my loved one. And many times they have sort of a spiritual adversity to the death penalty, either in the Old Testament or the New Testament. And sometimes there are just people that are just seem to want to forgive and move on with their lives. And so there's Ross Byrd in particular, but I got to know the two sisters, Ross's two sisters, Renee and Jamie. Renee was very instrumental in the hate crimes legislation that
with Matthew Shepard and James Byrd.
Well, with James Byrd, yeah, the one that took place here in Texas. And they were all, you know, Jamie, Renee, Ross were very strong against the death penalty and spoke out against it publicly, which is another thing. You can be against it, but if you speak out against it, I heard today that both of James Byrd Jr.'s sisters have spoken out. I think that's amazing. I don't know if they've always been in that position. Sometimes it takes time for people to get to that position of saying, I don't want the death penalty, I forgive, or at least have some sort of a reconciliation, because it's such a horrible thing when it happens. But the children in particular, Ross and his two sisters, were from the death penalty from the get-go. And Ross, at that time, was also very public. We were invited by some people in Europe to come over and for Ross. So Ross and I actually went to Europe, where he did a speaking tour against the death penalty in Europe, and particularly in Italy. And very, very strong against the death penalty for any of the three men. And of course, we know that two of them have got the death penalty and one got life without parole. So the other amazing thing that happened, because when Ross was speaking out back then, it got a fair amount of publicity, and the Texas Civil Rights Project up in Austin also honored him. We went up to Austin, and Senator Ted Kennedy was there as their special guest. Mm-hmm. And so Ross got to meet Ted Kennedy and got their picture taken together. It was a pretty big thing all the way around.
Of course, the time right now is 6:30. You are listening to Execution Watch. This is a special program. We are currently preempting Arab Voices. They will be back next week. At this time, there is still no word from the Supreme Court regarding a possible stay for John King. We were waiting for our reporter from in front of the death house to let us know if by chance the chaplain has gone across. There are no witnesses for John King's execution today. Let's get back a little bit, if we may.
Sure.
Talk a bit about the... we've been discussing about the family of James Byrd, his children, Jamie, Renee, Ross. We've been talking about the sisters a bit, Luvon Harris and Betty Boitner. Tell us a little bit about the James Byrd Foundation.
Well, I don't have a lot of details on it. I know it's the Byrd Foundation for Racial Healing. Mm-hmm. And what I would like to say is that as horrific as this crime was, a terrible, terrible crime, there are some things that came out of it that will help our society. The Byrd Foundation for Racial Healing. God knows we need racial healing still in this day and age. We don't have too many of these kind of crimes, but we have, we have a fair amount of racism still in our society, sometimes at the very highest level of government. And I've also been connected with the Center for the Healing of Racism here in Houston with Cherry Steinwender. Wonderful, wonderful organization. And then the hate crime legislation that came forth afterwards. So out of Texas originally, and then it was signed a law was made into law by Barack Obama several years later. So, you know, there's some, sometimes it almost takes the worst things to happen for some movement forward in certain issues. And
these are certainly two high-profile, very visible and horrible cases, specifically regarding hate crimes, the Matthew Shepard and, of course, James Byrd.
Absolutely.
If I may stop for just a moment, we have had word from the Supreme Court. They have turned down his appeal. So the execution will continue as planned.
Right.
Larry, there's so many components of this. The three different trials, different sentencing. How do you approach this legally? What do you think about this?
Well, just a couple of things. And Dave mentioned that Lawrence Brewer got life without parole. Well, actually, there's no life without parole for Lawrence. At the time Lawrence Brewer was tried, we didn't have life without parole. So Lawrence Brewer will be eligible for parole.
But he's dead.
Sean Berry.
You get those mixed up every
Sean Berry. Okay, yeah. Sean yeah. Berry got a license.
It would be interesting if
okay.
Mr. Brewer was...
I'm sorry. I misspoke there. So Sean Berry is eligible for parole after 40 years.
So
in 2038, he'll be eligible for parole. We do now have a life without parole law in Texas. But Sean Berry got just a life sentence, which at that time would have been 40 years before first eligible for parole.
Right.
In terms of John King's execution, and this is just my opinion, okay, on how I find the legal system to work, those within the power system, the power structure, do have a certain attitude about treating, having some sense of treating everybody pretty much equally, if they can. Okay, so John King has pretty much exhausted his remedies, and he was the supposed ringleader, and the fact that now Lawrence Brewer has been executed in 2011, I think that weighed heavily. I believe it did on saying, let's go ahead and execute this guy. You know, I've had, you know, prosecutors who just, you know, sometimes are really strong about, if I've got a guy who's got co-defendants, and they very well might have, if they've sentenced the other co-defendant and he got a lesser sentence than what they're offering my guy, almost every time you point that out, you know, my guy has the same, has a better, not as bad a background as the guy you've already sentenced, and you're asking for this sentence on him, and even if he's guilty, so what gives?
Right.
And I've had that happen time and time again.
Is this a good example of how the death penalty is not applied equally?
It's not applied equally. It can't be. Nothing in the law is done equally. But there's this attitude of some sort of attitude of parity and equitable application within the experience of the person you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I really suspect that. I don't know for a fact, but you know, it surprised me, Dave, also. Mm-hmm. When the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said, you know, and their statement was that the McCoy case stated that a defendant is entitled to direct his lawyer on his theory of the defense. And if you want to, and in McCoy's case, I mean, now, there were ways of distinguishing McCoy from this case, but McCoy said when he first gets arrested, I didn't do that. I was someplace. I've got an alibi. He's going looking for alibis. And he was very, very specific on that in terms of my actual innocence defense. In John King's case, his defenses were all over the board. I mean, he had this defense, that defense, complaining about, you know, my lawyer should have done this, my lawyer should have done that, my lawyer should have tried this, should have tried that. So his reasons for claiming error were just all over the board. They were not targeted because he was complaining about everything, which good appellate lawyers do. Okay, just complain about everything. But the other thing is, it seems as though that strong alibi defense by John King was just not made that early. Just not made
early enough.
Not early enough, and not strongly enough. And also the McCoy case was not specifically deemed to be retroactive.
So he's out of remedies. The execution is going to go forward. What does it actually say about our system? What is this telling us?
Well, it to me, you know, I'm strongly anti-death penalty for anyone, even the worst crime, and this was in the category of the very, very worst. Of course, there's no good murder in any case. I don't know. To me, it's just that I'm on the prison show here in KPFT, and I always talk about, you know, we're using the death penalty as some sort of a supposed remedy for a horrible crime. And we're at the wrong end of the spectrum on preventing violent crime. If we really want to prevent and reduce the number of horrible crimes, including this crime, this kind of a crime, we have to start at the other end of the spectrum and work on prevention. And somehow, and I'm on my soapbox now, I know. The death penalty, people think the death penalty, and particularly people say, well, this is the death case, they really deserve the death penalty. But that's always the thinking, or that's what people say who support the death penalty. This case really deserves it. And it's not an enlightened perspective, in my opinion, on how to have a civilized society. And, you know, we have now 20 states in the United States that have abolished the death penalty. We have about another 20 states that rarely use it, if ever. We have about three or four states have a real moratorium. on the death penalty, but there are even other states that don't have the moratorium are not using it. And I think the reason for that is that they have they've seen the light, so to speak. And no, go ahead.
I know that our next execution, our next scheduled execution, of course, is May the 2nd with Dexter Johnston. So, with Dexter Johnson, excuse me. I've just received word that our reporter, Linda Hujan, is on line one. Let's see what she has to say. Linda.
Yes.
What's going on, please?
Okay, now all the chaplains have crossed the line, so the execution is proceeding.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And keep us informed, please.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
So, do you want me to pick up on?
Yes, please.
So, I do see, I've been looking at this for about 25 years now, and I've seen tremendous inconsistency. And I know you're never going to get that inconsistency out of the criminal justice, but the inconsistency based on economics, race, and geography. And my number one soapbox item right now is that the Supreme Court, I don't think Texas is going to do away with the death penalty anytime soon based on the politics of this state. But I think if the Supreme Court took a real objective look at this issue and looked at all the inconsistencies that have taken place, and there are probably four members of the Supreme Court, you bring that 5-4 breakdown again, there are four members of the Supreme Court that probably would vote for a total abolition of the death penalty like they did back in the early 70s. And it was based on saying that the death penalty was arbitrary and capricious in violation of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. And I think, and they tried to improve things, and maybe they did improve them a little bit, but we've got all these years of experience to show that the death penalty is still, in my opinion, arbitrary and capricious, not just my opinion, a lot of people.
But we are starting to see a lot less execution scheduled.
Right.
And
right.
The death penalty has, as you said earlier, with life without parole, things are changing. Is that right?
Oh, I believe they are. Now, we can't overlook the fact that the death penalty is a lot about vengeance. And it's also politically motivated. And in this case was a real big hot button issue. In that the racial overtones, the strong racial overtones, and the strong feeling, political feeling, that the daughter, the sister who said she was going to attend, was attending for her mother, but her mother passed away. And her mother's concern was not having lived to see justice being done. Okay. This is a black guy being killed by white boys. And in the black community, the feeling is, they'll never execute a white guy for killing a black guy. And so there's a lot of that out there. Saying that, so justice, after all, there have been a lot of black guys being executed for killing white people. So, but this nation will never do that. And there has to be some thought that, hey, we've got to show that we will actually execute a white guy, back two white guys, and send a third to prison. And this appears to be the case for doing it, because this, you've heard the word lynching used in more than one occasion, mm-hmm. in association with this case, and that word carries with it so much strong emotion that had to push a lot of people to say, we've got to prove that's certainly there. On the other side of this, John King is 44 years old. And I can see what he did. Okay,
so he was in his 20s when this happened.
He was in his 20s when it happened, and he was clearly a racist. Okay, clearly a racist, but who is he today? Is a question that has to be asked And so often the answer is, well, maybe we should have done this 20 years ago. And we wouldn't have to answer that question, because he's delaying it for so long that we're beginning to look at it a little bit differently. But it's a question that we do have to ask, because, again, he was a very young man, as they all were.
But both he and Sean had already done time. What about Lawrence Brewer? Had he already done time as well?
I don't know about Brewer.
They were just Jasper buddies.
I just don't know.
Yeah,
just don't know. And I don't think that Sean Berry had done serious time. I mean, the claim is that he knew James Brewer from jail. Okay, so I mean, but John King had been to prison.
Right.
And going to jail is one thing. You can go to jail for some pretty minor stuff, right. But
think
going
we
to prison,
can all agree on that.
going to prison is another. Okay,
yeah.
You know, there was some strong evidence suggesting that John King was trying to start a chapter of the Confederate Knights of America right there in Jasper. That was strong. Now, he said, well, I was getting ready to move to Georgia. Yeah, you said you were getting ready to move to Georgia, but you hadn't asked for the last couple of months. And you did. John King did himself a lot of harm. One, he wrote a letter to the Dallas Morning News, which suggested his guilt by saying he wrote a letter to the Morning News, okay, and also wrote a letter to Brewer, okay, complaining about Sean Berry and saying, you know, we'll go down in history. Now, and he tried to complain about his lawyer for not covering him for that, but he did himself, as a lot of young men do crazy things. He didn't do himself any good, did himself a lot of harm just by his writing. Again, he's 44 years old today. He's 44 years old as of now. He's not going to get to be 45. There's a lot of balancing that goes on there, balancing competing interests.
And Mr. Byrd, how old was he when he was murdered?
49. 49 years old.
So I really agree with what you say in terms of the environment. And I really can understand how a lot of people would say, look at this is time for some justice. This country has such a history of racism, such a history of lynchings. And a lot of people aren't aware of it, especially white people are not aware of that, or they don't want to be aware of it, or they don't want to recognize it and acknowledge it. That center that was just recently started over in Alabama, the Remembrance Project on Lynching History, there's an effort I know in Houston, because Harris County had several lynchings here, not a lot, not like some other places, but Texas was sure into lynchings, and the South was into lynching, and even some not so much in the South. So there's that history that I think that we have to recognize, and I can understand how a lot of people would say this is time for some justice on this issue. I'm glad this, Rodney Ellis, Commissioner Ellis, now is very involved in bringing that Remembrance Project to Houston, and they're working very strongly on it. And it's something, it's got to be, there's got to be a wake up for a lot of white people on the history of this country. And if people are waffling a little bit on it or are not aware of it, they need to become aware of it. And although I'm totally against the death penalty for anybody, for any reason, I can understand strong feelings on that issue, because this was such a horrible racist crime. And I can understand why some people had to make a statement on this, definitely. In fact, when it comes to the death penalty in general, I've talked to a lot of people over the years, And anybody, even in a family who has had somebody murdered, I usually, if they come up and say, I'm sorry, you know, I'm for the death penalty, I would never argue with them knowing the pain that they've experienced. I might tell them, well, I'm not, and I might give them my reasons, but we have to acknowledge that, and particularly with this crime, how horrific this crime was, and how racist this crime was, and how, you know, when you have it happen basically in your backyard in Jasper, Texas, you know, you're going to get that reaction. I understand that. I was never upset at the family, you know, the ones in the family who were saying, we would like the death penalty for those three guys. I could understand that. But on the other side, like I was mentioning before, I was so amazed at the Byrd children and how they saw things differently.
That is amazing. That
It's just amazing.
Spirit of forgiveness is beyond the.
And I've seen people with the anger of something happening in their family. There was one family here in Houston. Their daughter was raped and murdered by a gang of boys. And the dad in particular, never got over it. He never got over it. He was so mad. But I think his anger that he internalized ultimately led to his early death.
But on the racial aspect of this whole thing, on the racial aspect, there are black people who do not go to Jasper, okay, who just say, look, you know, before this, they already were. But after this, I mean, there are black people who would not even stop to fill up their car in Jasper. So
right.
You better get gas. And if you're going to Louisiana, get gasoline before you leave Texas. If you're even going to Beaumont before you leave Houston, fill up before you leave Houston. If this car, if you have a flat, ride the rims all the way to Beaumont.
Yeah.
Do not stop in Jasper.
Right.
Okay. And that has not improved any.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's got a reputation.
Oh, it does. And there, I've known guys who have construction crews that like, I don't work on housing yet, Jasper. Mm-hmm. I'm certain if I go, I'm not going to be caught in Jasper after sundown.
Right.
Just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's today. I'm not talking about 1998.
No, I know. I'm
talking about today.
I've got some friends who are actually white, but they have a grandson who's black.
Okay.
And I recall them telling me they were going to be taking the bus from somewhere, the school bus to, I think it was New Orleans, but the route was going to take them through Jasper.
Oh, yeah. If you're going out I-10 east, you're going to go through Jasper.
And they told their grandson, they said, don't get off the bus in Jasper.
It's rather ironic that Jasper's city motto is Jasper, where life is well lived? Mm. I guess.
Yeah. Well, we've got a long ways to go. On many fronts, we have a long ways to go. And this was obviously painful.
Oh, yeah. When you consider James Byrd Jr., I mean, he lived in Jasper, he felt comfortable walking the streets in Jasper. His friend said, you know, James was not even concerned about anything, no danger. And if he's walking along the road, okay, his feeling is I'll pretty much walk where I want to go. And somebody always stops to give me a ride if I need a ride. So he was walking back and forth. And so the fear is, wait a minute, if you're just walking along the road and somebody offers you a ride, you get in the back of the truck, and this happens to you, that is frightening.
Yeah,
to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
Reasonably frightening.
Definitely. I've got one other. When you're ready, I got one other comment on the case.
Please.
I don't have the details that you have, Mr. Douglas, but I did read. I just want to make this point that the DA in this case, when pleading for the death penalty, said, "If you don't give the death penalty to this man, he will kill again." And you know, probably better than I do, that is the argument that DAs often give to get the death penalty on anybody, that they want to get the death penalty again.
That's required by law, future danger. So if they've got to show that he's a future, yeah. convince the jury that he's a future danger.
Right, and that's one of the things that I always say, look at now, we do have life without parole now. We did have, back then, it was a life sentence. If you've got life without parole, and I think the prison system's pretty good at keeping people controlled if they need to.
We're running out of time, but all I say to that is Texas 7, and that refused, the Texas 7, they were in prison, they broke out and killed somebody.
That's the exception.
But I'm saying that's the argument you're going to hear.
Yeah, that's the argument you're going to hear. Oh, yeah. But most, I don't think it's a, I don't think it's an argument that really works for most people and or hardly anybody, because you do have life. I don't know if they had life. Those guys didn't have life without parole.
No, but they were in prison.
Yeah.
Just a last report coming in from Huntsville. Our reporter Linda Hujan reports that there is no movement yet. So the execution probably has not finished.
Okay.
We'll stand by for that. Again, gentlemen, thank you so much. It is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us again on May the 2nd when the state of Texas plans to execute Dexter Johnson. We invite you to visit us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all the latest updates, and please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others, and make your secure contribution to this station. I want to thank our Larry B. Douglas. I want to thank Dave Atwood for joining us today. Our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein. Technical assistance by Mark Pirtle. Our engineer, Rick Campbell. Thank you for joining the crew for all of their assistance on today's program. The show and the recorded interview will be broadcast on Houston Media Source later date, and check hmstv.org for scheduling. Up next, People of Earth. Thank you for listening. I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.